Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. My name is Derek Litvak, and I'll be your host. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Kari Aronde-Polk about his book, Contagions of Empire, Scientific Racism, Sexuality, and Black Military Workers Abroad, 1898 to 1948, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2020. Dr. Polk is an Associate Professor of Black Studies and Sexuality, Women, and Gender Studies at Amherst College. Contagions of Empire examines how the shifting views of Black military workers through the first half of the 20th century as the U.S. increased its global empire in warfare. At once viewed as both contagious and immune, Black workers attempted to navigate the complex pathways that were left open in the military, even as they were seen as simultaneously integral and threatening to both the U.S. military and nation state. Dr. Polk's work shows not just how scientific racism developed during this period and how U.S. militarism expanded, but how the Black community responded at each step. Dr. Polk, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Derek. It's great to be here.
So I guess to get things started, can you tell our listeners how you came to this topic and why you decided to study it?
Sure. Well, one of the things I can say is this story is connected to my own family history in the sense that my father and both of my grandfathers served in the U.S. military. My grandfather served in the Army and my father served in the Air Force. I grew up in an African-American military family. We were stationed in England and Okinawa, Japan. And when I started graduate school at NYU, it was also September 11th. And so at that time, there were many robust critiques of the American military and American militarism in particular. And I thought that these critiques were important, but I also felt that there was something lacking in the awareness of the actual conditions of service and thinking about the relationship between service and servitude. And racism was one of the ways I began to refocus this study. And I also wanted to figure out how to move beyond a hagiographic narrative of Black enlistment. For many reasons and important reasons, many historians have felt the need of discussing the Black soldier as a hero, as a way of combating the negative portrayals that have historically attended to the discussion of Black military service in histories. I wanted to move away from, let's say, a figure such as the Tuskegee Airmen and look at other actors, some of them common, some of them exceptional, in order to try to find a different story of African-American military service in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, I think one of the best ways sort of coming to a project that I find is, you know, sort of having that personal connection. I think a lot of people sort of think that historians are just like, okay, I'm just going to throw a dart at a wall and, you know, pick this. You know, scholars are just going to randomly pick something. And it's like, no, a lot of times we have a sort of connection to this topic.
Exactly. And I know that in many ways, I probably moved away from this topic for many years in graduate school. And that is probably just a symptom of being a military brat and wanting to get as far away from the military as possible. Or I would say incorrectly believing that anything there was to know about Black people in the military, I knew it because I lived it. And what happened after graduate school and when I began to teach courses on military history at Amherst, I began to discover so much of what I didn't know and things that I wasn't sure my parents knew. And I became fascinated and reinvigorated to look at aspects of this history that in many ways I feel have been left out of the modern narrative of Black military service. And in many ways, I mean this in the best possible way. But when you see public discussions of Black military memory, there is a way in which we can talk about the Civil War, and then we sort of move quickly to World War I. Sometimes we might even pass World War I to go to World War II. And in graduate school, I kind of moved away from, I sort of looked at that history in the same light. And it wasn't until I stopped to reflect upon the Spanish-Cuban-American War of 1898 that I found a story that at least for my own, for I guess my own sense of being, I felt that there was a story that had not been told. And I wanted to spend more time on that 1898 war, because I thought that it was important for the construction of African-American identity and the discussion of Black military service abroad.
And so in terms of your work, you know, a couple of concepts are sort of integral to, you know, your work here, one of which is in the title of Contagions of Empire. And so how do you define and use terms like immunity and contagion in your work? Because as you show, there's a multitude of meanings across time for these words.
Right. The first thing I would say is that these terms weren't terms that I went into the book looking to prove. And they were terms that came out of the research, in many ways, out of the archive, that for me, they were begging to be considered and theorized. So I'll start with immunity, because that was the term that for me has many, many meanings, which I try to pin down throughout the text. So immunity, I think when we normally think about immunity, we think about, let's say, biological immunity. We think about, you know, that you might receive from childhood bouts of chickenpox. Or we think about the kinds of immunities that police officers receive or foreign dignitaries might receive. And I found immunity a term that was really important for African Americans in the mid to late 19th century, specifically in terms of thinking about the use of the term immunity in the 14th Amendment, where the first sentence, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And that was a term that I began to see pop up in African-American journalism and letters to editors of Black newspapers, especially at the end of the 19th century. And it was a term that became a synonym for rights and privileges of citizenship. Now, that term, I think, it changed its meaning a bit when we look at the rationale for enlisting African-American men and women during the Spanish-Cuban-American War. There was a sense that yellow fever and other tropical diseases would be problematic for American troops in Cuba. And there was a belief that was popular during slavery that African Americans, and specifically African American women, were resistant or immune to yellow fever. So this term became used as a way to employ African American soldiers and African American women as nurses, and the black men were enlisted in immune regiments. And again, this is the idea of the belief that black people are still immune to yellow fever, and black women were enlisted as immune nurses. And so I saw both of these uses of immunity together in the first use of African American men and women for military service abroad at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And I began to see that the way in which African American leaders used this term was a term that emphasize the political notions of the term. There are moments where people talk about the notion of what kind of political immunity we receive based upon the service of black men and women abroad. But I began to see the way in which immunity was also used to talk about the sacrifice of African American men and women in military service.
And one of the things that you mentioned there were these immune regimens. And so what are these? I think a lot of people may be vaguely familiar with, you know, the ideas that you were just talking about. But they probably, if they are, they might think that that was, you know, something of, you know, the antebellum period, that didn't really carry on. But as you're showing, like, no, this has, you know, deep impact in American history and it continues forward.
Right. Well, the thing that for me is so fascinating about these regiments is that they were mobilized in a period of time in which medical and scientific consensus on the vector of yellow fever in the United States was far from unanimous. And in fact, I think that one of the things that I struggled with was trying to understand how true was this belief of black people being seen as immune to contagious diseases. And it's not until, I believe, 1901 that American researchers confirm that yellow fever, the vector of yellow fever, was the mosquito. And so in this period, in some ways from, let's say, 1898 to 1901, in lieu of a true understanding of the pathology of yellow fever, scientists and military officials and African-American leaders, they began to rely upon the myth of black people being immune. And that sense of immunity served multiple ends for military officials. It meant that you had a class of persons ready to do the work that many white troops refused to do. So you have cases in Cuba where there were white American troops who refused to work at yellow fever camps because they thought that this was a way of inviting death into their lives. But you also had African-American leaders like Booker T. Washington and Namioka Curtis, who felt that being able to show their patriotism by serving in these perilous conditions would be one way in which all of America would recognize that African-Americans were citizens and deserved full citizenship rights in the country. And so this was, I would say that that immune regiment, their mobilization was something that happened in the spring of 1898. And there was lots of debates in white and black newspapers about the notion of immunity and whether or not it was true. And in fact, you had white newspapers who really scoffed at the fact of this of the idea of immunity being present in any Southern population based upon the yellow fever outbreaks having not taken place in certain counties for 10 or 20 years. But still, this was a moment in which African Americans felt as though that this is our chance to show the country that we are citizens, that we will fight on our country's behalf. And they did it.
And I find it just, you know, really interesting because you have this sort of, you know, idea that, you know, that I think a lot of people are familiar with where, you know, you serve in the military and it gives you a sort of, you know, better claim on, you know, citizenship rights and everything like that when you come from a marginalized group, that this has historically been a pathway to that marginalized groups use to, you know, claim better rights. And they also have to, in this case, black people have to, you know, navigate this really, you know, quite frankly, weird assumption that they are somehow immune from these deadly diseases.
Right. And I think that was hard to reckon with. And to see the different sorts of black organizations that signed on to this belief made it gave me pause. But I also had to realize that in so many ways, science. I think that the process-oriented notion of science becomes clearer when we're not thinking about, let's say, our now. And looking back into the archive. And so in that moment in 1898, when it really did seem as though that this was an opportunity that black folks could jump on and to really make good out of, this was something that I think that black people felt somewhat comfortable in signing up to do. Now, I will say that in terms of black women being seen as particular immune to yellow fever, that was so fascinating to me because it relied on the idea of the of the quote unquote mammy figure on plantations, who at least in the archives that I looked at showed histories where black women were seen. Black women on plantations, if there was a plantation beset by yellow fever, that they then became the people who took care of the entire plantation. And so those ideas about black womanhood were folded into the rationale used to recruit black women for their first international war as immune nurses.
And so, yeah, speaking about immune nurses, you know, what does their experience in this war, you know, tell us about not just, you know, the black community and black women's sort of struggle in the United States during this time period, but just about, you know, how, you know, the gendered characteristics of race and medicine look during this period?
That's a great question. I think that the experience of black women shows that black womanhood, I think, has just been a constant resource for forms of labor, and specifically, I would say, care labor in this sense. And so what I found fascinating were news reports that showed that some of the women who served in Cuba had also served as nurses during the Civil War. But they also had some of younger nurses who had been trained at segregated colored nursing schools as well. And I think that what occurred was that Black women were cognizant of the way in which they were being caricatured in the media and treated by certain soldiers and doctors. And they were savvy enough to attempt to fracture the servile caricature and stereotypes of the mammy figure in speaking to journalists, in talking about their service and demanding their rights. And so I think that we can look at long histories of the way in which Black womanhood has been marshaled for different projects of racial capitalism. And this was a history that I myself was unfamiliar with, and it felt important to spend lots of time to articulate the voices of these women who had not been a part of any of the standard narratives of the Spanish-Cuban American War.
Yeah, I know for myself, you know, the little bit of the Spanish-Cuban American War that, you know, I was exposed to, you know, in a high school, in college, is, you know, typical, sort of just, you know, one, it's just like kind of glossed over because it's seen as such a short war. You definitely don't learn about Black people in general, and you definitely don't learn about Black women's role in the war.
You don't. And I think that what was so frustrating to see in the literature, or let's say some of the primary sources, was that even as Black women were being praised by the Black community for their service in this war, you also saw their immediate erasure. And so when they returned to the U.S. After their service, and their service, you know, it included, you know, everything from treating soldiers to really helping to bury the dead, and nurses themselves became sick. So again, this whole notion of immunity was a really dangerous gambit, a political gambit that many people took. When they returned to the U.S., this is when, though they had in many ways changed through their service, the U.S. had not changed at all. And so even in terms of returning home, they experienced racism and accommodations and public conveyances returning to the South. And this was very, they were very angry. And you began to see their anger in terms of as righteous as veterans who had been spurned. And that was something that I wanted to contend with, that emotion, especially because, again, this was something that I had never been taught. There were footnotes that referred to these workers, and I have to thank those scholars who helped me think through these ideas and to spend a bit more time with them.
Speaking of things that we don't usually learn about, one of the people that you focus on is a man named Charles Young, and what I would consider very interesting documents that he leaves behind, that you're able to reconstruct, you know, his views around Black military service and everything during this time period. And so who is Charles Young, and what are the sources that you were able to find that deal with him and are from him?
Charles Young is so fascinating, and in so many ways, it's you know, I say or think of Charles Young, and I think of General Colin Powell, just in terms of the kind of impact that Young had in the late 19th and early 20th century. Charles Young was the son of enslaved Black folks, and he was the third African-American to go to West Point. He became, during his lifetime, the highest ranking African-American military officer. Now, he reached the rank of colonel, but he was controversially retired on the eve of World War I, supposedly because of a heart condition. But it became really clear in terms of the work that I studied and some of the other documents that I found that there was fear from the military hierarchy that an African-American man could not or should not ever be seen as a highest ranking rank in the army. So he was retired at colonel and was not able to become general. Now, this was something that really hurt him because throughout his life, he really believed that he was fighting both for race and for country. And he spent the bulk of his military career trying to reconcile these two strivings. He was also a brilliant man in so many ways. He spoke a number of languages. So on top of being a polyglot, he was a cartographer. He was a musician, and he was a playwright. And there are a number, his archive, I think, is something that I stumbled upon. And I didn't know that I would spend so much time thinking about his life. But in terms of his striving of wanting to be the first general or first African-American general in the U.S. Army, he had an idol who he spent a lot of time thinking about. And this was Toussaint Louverture, famous General Louverture from the Haitian Revolution. So as Young was going through his career, he had a wonderful assignment as the first military attaché or American military attaché in Haiti. And this was a wonderful assignment for him because he turned his time in Haiti into a kind of a research sabbatical. And while there, he began to write a five-act play about the Haitian Revolution, focusing upon Louverture. And so this was a play that he began writing in around 1905. And he didn't finish the play until 1920 when he was stationed in Liberia. Now, the 19 version of that play has been lost to history. Hopefully someone can find it at some point. But the version that we have access to is from 1910. And so reading that really sort of kind of amazing 160-page document says as much about his interpretation of the Haitian Revolution as it does about Young himself. And it shows that in many ways it's a tragedy in terms of, however we think about the Haitian Revolution, we know that Louverture's being disappeared from Haiti and brought to Europe was a tragic end for this amazing fellow. And that's something that Young meditates upon in his play. And in some ways, though this version we have from 1910 it's an amazing version. I wish I had access to the one that he wrote and 1920. But the 1910 version, in some ways, offers a kind of prophetic memoir because it helps to understand the betrayal that Young felt by not being allowed to become a general in the U.S. Army and serving in World War One, which, of course, he would have been extremely useful because he spoke German and French, right? But I would say one of the other parallels that I think is very helpful about his narrative and Louverture's is that he is also, in some ways, at least I argue that he was exiled to Liberia and in many ways sent to Liberia to die because once he had been retired or forcibly retired by the U.S. military, he became much more radical and active. And one of his best friends during this time was W.E.B. Du Bois. And their relationship to me is so fascinating. They met at Wilberforce University, in many ways at the beginning of both of their careers, and remained fast friends. The other aspect of the tragic nature of Young's life is that I believe that Du Bois saw him as a figure besotted by double consciousness, that everything he did in order to prove himself worthy to be an officer was something that had his own identity. His own identity was always being judged by white people. And I think that was a difficult aspect of their relationship that was never quite reconciled. But I think that Du Bois and Young together are just really amazing men to consider at that period of time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I know, as someone who is, you know, I'm an early Americanist, really. I study, you know, the late 18th and early 19th century. And so sort of reading that, you know, this person who is, you know, as you said, you know, the most successful black soldier in the military during this time period. And then, you know, he basically gets ousted by the military because they don't want someone who's going to keep rising in the ranks and everything like that. And then, as you said, he sort of is exiled to Liberia. And for me, you know, there's, you know, the old saying that, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme, in terms of, you know, this high ranking, successful black military worker who is, you know, sort of comparing himself to Toussaint Louverture, spends time in Haiti and everything like that, and then ends up going to, you know, a country that was created by the American Colonization Society in order to get rid of slavery and to prop up slavery at the same time.
I'm resistant to hero worship, right? It's like I'm attracted to fascinating subjects, and I love personally the conflict I have in trying to understand Jung. That Jung is someone who was a African-American military imperialist at his heart. And yet, I also believe that his choice to go to Haiti at the last 2 years of his life, a choice that Du Bois was like, don't do it. He's like, they're going there to kill you. You know, come on. But he also had the sense of duty that I think in some ways overshadows his own agency. I believe that he decided to spend the rest of his life in Liberia as a military imperialist because he refused to live the rest of his life under the American veil. And so he had to reconcile his own position as a African American, as a soldier, as a military imperialist, and I would say as a nascent Black nationalist, because I think that is what I discovered through the play about the Haitian Revolution. That the play to me is this fascinating text that is so radical, both in terms of everything that we know about Charles Jung, but even what we know about plays written during that period. I mean, there's a moment in which in the play that Louverture is critiquing someone who is going to use the N-word to describe him. And then the person stops. But then Louverture, you know, says through Jung's hand, he's like, you know what, listen, you know, you can say that word. In fact, that's a term, you know, that we're reclaiming. You know, that there is no shame around that term. And if you yourself, and I think he was talking to someone of mixed blood, you know, if you yourself, you know, weren't infected with white blood, you know, you yourself would, you know, would be able to claim this term as yours as well. And so I really love the fact that Jung was able to use theater to stage ideas that publicly he had never raised until towards the end of his life. And so, though I think that both the Louverture play was a tragedy, and in some ways we might see Jung's life as a tragedy, and I think that's the way that many people normally read Jung, I resist that. I resist that because I like him as a complicated figure. Because I think that honestly, anyone who serves in the U.S. military as a person of color, you know, as an unrepresented minority, has to deal with this conflict of what it means to serve empire. What does it mean to be an imperialist and subaltern at the same time? And so, I love the fact that I can't recover Jung cleanly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you're working on next, but I almost feel like there needs to be a full length biography of this. I don't know. It's just, it's such an interesting topic.
It's pretty, I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, one of the things I want to work on is actually getting that play back into the, back into the public. I mean, what shocked me is the fact that this play, and I understand scholars sometimes were like, you know, no one's ever seen this. And that wasn't my approach to this. In fact, I wanted to see all the secondary literature on this play. But I have discovered myself that African-American military service, there is a particular standard narrative of how we think about it. And it hasn't really moved much farther than that. So from what I can tell, other than two of his biographers mentioning this play, it's a play that has never been placed within a kind of, you know, African-American literary discourse. And I would love other scholars to think about this play and to think about the contradictions and the possibilities of African-American military imperialism.
And so, you know, going forward in terms of, you know, the other things that you discuss in the book, one of the things that you look at is the sort of competing visions between, you know, the Black community and the military in particular about, you know, venereal diseases and, you know, a Black infected body. And so what is going on there?
Well, this is where I'd say the other term, which we mentioned earlier, contagion, comes into play. So we have this notion of the immune body, which is useful for American imperial interests abroad. So we see Black soldiers used not only in Cuba, but Puerto Rico and the Philippines. We go through when we get to World War One. World War France is a moment in which you have American officers, some who were actually were civilians, who wanted to find a way to bring their interests and concerns into a military lens. And so you have two doctors who were urologists from Johns Hopkins University, David Walker and Hugh Hampton Young. Hugh Hampton Young, I think, is important because to this day, he's understood as the father of modern American urology. So they believed that in order for the U.S. to be successful during World War One, especially in France, that there needed to be a war fought against venereal diseases and infections. So in order to do this, Hampton Young used a technique that was popularized by New Zealand officers. And this was known as chemical prophylaxis. Chemical prophylaxis, I think, is an interesting procedure because folks who work in health and medicine and sexuality today are probably familiar with forms of pre-exposure prophylaxis around HIV and AIDS, right? But this notion of prophylaxis has a much longer history. And chemical prophylaxis was something that if you as a soldier had gone and had sex with a woman, and again, the presumption is that you're having sex with a woman and that the woman you're having sex with is a prostitute, that there's a good chance that you would be infected by some kind of disease or infection. So chemical prophylaxis involved taking after your let's say your sexual activity, coming back to the base, and then getting a pro-treatment, a prophylactic treatment, which involved silver compounds being injected into the urethra and held for around 5 minutes before letting it pass. Then after that, you were supposed to take a mercury chloride and as a kind of salve and rub that around the genitalia, genital area for 3 more minutes. So that was promoted during the time of the war as the U.S. military's greatest advance in treating venereal disease and infections. Now, it was clear that this process was a painful process. And Hugh Hampton Young himself was very clear that he did not approve of African-American soldiers or officers having any kind of sexual or romantic relations with French women, again, presumably white French women. And so for particular soldiers that were working in on the docks of France, and in fact, what is fascinating is that the image on the cover of my book, it's a sort of French propaganda poster in support of African-American dock workers working on Saint-Nazaire docks, right? And so these are the figures that he, in fact, is concerned about, the dock workers leaving a work and then going to brothels and having sex with white women. So the idea was that whenever they left the base and they came back on, they actually had to endure this treatment, which was very painful. And this is where the idea of contagion pops up in my analysis, in the sense of the way in which Black men, and in this case, it's mostly the narrative moves almost exclusively to talk about Black masculinity. But it's a moment in which Black men were seen as contagious bodies that needed to be surveilled and regulated. And their bodies needed to be tortured in many ways to make them remember, make them feel what their minds could not be expected to remember. And so this idea of the contagious body and the contagious venereal body was something that was part of World War One, and it was a part of many of those officers once they left the military. They helped to institutionalize it into popular American public health discourse.
And so, speaking about World War One, how does this sort of vision of U.S. wars and Black military service change, you know, by the time and throughout and after World War One inside of the Black community? Because, as you said, you know, with the Spanish-Cuban-American War, there's largely this belief that, like we said, a lot of people are familiar with, that, you know, you see military service as being an avenue towards having greater claims on rights. And it doesn't mean that it's not a sort of complicated process, but there's, you know, widespread, you know, support for these, you know, U.S. imperial visions and stuff like that. But as you point out, by the time we get to World War One and afterwards, things have sort of radically changed. And so what's going on there?
So at this moment is when you begin to see, and it feels very contemporary to me in terms of debates happening between, let's say, you know, older activists like Du Bois, and some of the let's say the younger activists who basically say that, listen, you know, so many people have attempted to use military service in order to bring greater rights to the African American community, and it simply does not work. You know, why are we participating in the domination of people? Globally, right? But once we move to World War II, it definitely becomes much more of a global conversation. And so there's lots of critiques that are happening and resistance movements that are occurring. But you also still, you have, and for me, I think that this discourse, it's a very healthy discourse. It's healthy in terms of seeing the kind of debates that were happening within the African-American community. And that there seemed to be a way in which, regardless of what you felt, whether or not African Americans should serve in the military or they should not, it was clear that they were continued. It was clear that they were still being used, and so in this moment, I think Black Americans had to figure out another relationship to the U.S. military. And I think part of what they discovered is that though life overseas, you still often had to contend with white surveillance, there were also moments of possibility. And I think that some of this possibility was actualized in sexual relationships with foreign people. But in some of it was just, but sex wasn't the only mode in which I think people began to find a different possibility. And again, so similar to the choice that Charles Young made to exile himself in Liberia at the end of his life, I think that African-American soldiers who began to see life outside of the United States as offering a new way of being, that they could see themselves as both desiring and desired subjects. That itself helped to produce a new global consciousness. And so especially when we begin to look at World War II, when some of the same forms of surveillance were impacting Black life medically, that they moved on from chemical prophylaxis and the military moved on and began to use sulfa drugs. So drugs that you could take orally in order to take care of STIs and STDs. So those forms of surveillance still existed, but you also had the opportunities produced just through global contact. So seeing black soldiers in West Africa, seeing black soldiers in Iran, seeing black soldiers, especially in Germany, created, in my view, the basis for the idea that military service and serving abroad was like a breath of freedom for American GIs or African-American GIs. And that's something that I believe that we still live in the wake of those, that idea. And at least I can say that that is some of the history that I found myself and my family, being heir to, the idea that, that there was another way of living outside of the United States. And I guess the final point I would make about that is that I think that the book itself, as a history, but also as a history with a kind of theoretical foundation, really is attempting to just make clear that there is in fact a long history or a genealogy of black military thought. And I think that it's important for scholars, thinkers today to take that seriously. So at least, so you know, moving from 1898 to our contemporary moment, I think it's very helpful for us to think about the contradictions implied in African-Americans serving a country that hasn't always had had their interests at heart.
And so, you know, before we let you go, you know, once again, we have this great book in front of us, and I encourage our listeners to become readers and go pick it up. Once again, it's Contagions of Empire, Scientific Racism, Sexuality, and Black Military Workers Abroad, 1898 to 1948. And so we have this in front of us right now, and I know you said something about wanting to get Young's play back into the discourse, but what else might we expect from you in the future? What might you be working on now? And I know this just came out, so if you want to look at me and tell me I'm taking a much needed break, that is completely okay.
There are no breaks. So what I will say is that, you know, you always want to shove everything into your first book. And as someone who is a scholar of LGBT studies, I was personally frustrated that a lot of my chapters that involved with African-American lesbian and gay service members were not a part of this volume. But I received lots of feedback from my readers who said, you know, we understand that you want all this, but in fact, that's a separate project. And I really do begin to, I've understood it now as a new project. And looking at the end of World War II as a moment in which at the end of World War II, it became clear that African-American military workers were in some ways being seen as craftsmen now. That so they had moved from laborers to craftsmen. Doesn't mean that, you know, the more African-Americans would be promoted as officers as we see today, but it did mean that African-Americans could actually look to the military as a career. At that period, you also have the U.S. military beginning to patrol and surveil sexual difference. And so during World War II, while there were some gay and lesbians, you know, who were dismissed from the military service because of their sexuality or just the fear of their gender difference, you begin to see a history of African Americans who today we would say are lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans. We begin to see how they began to understand their time in the U.S. military. So, just to mention a couple of the subjects for that, I would say is that I found what I believe to be the only gay Tuskegee Airman who has not, I'm not even sure that the person who captured their oral history was aware of the significance. Because it was an oral history about gays and lesbians in the military during World War II, Alan Berube. But I'm not sure that Berube was really aware of the fact that he, in fact, was speaking to someone who was the only gay a Tuskegee Airman on record. So I'm interested in thinking about him. But I've also, for about a decade now, I've been doing a lot of work around the career of Perry Watkins, who was a gay African-American service member who was kicked out of the military for being open and honest about his sexuality, but after 14 years of service. And so in 1990, he received a victory in terms of being kicked out of the military for being gay. And so he received back wages and everything that was due to him. And so I'm interested in looking at, let's say, the end of World War II, to the present moment, but centering the voices of queer service members of color, and the same way that I didn't expect to find, let's say, immunity and contagion as the terms that animate this first book, I'm hoping that, though I do have a sense of the aim of the new project, I'm hopeful that there'll be other things that I can't expect that will come out of the research.
Well, that certainly sounds very interesting. And I'm sure once that project's done, we'll have you right back onto the program. But in any case, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. And be safe.